Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Sonia.
My name is Willie Simpson.
Today we've got Season 3, Episode 18, 44th overall, Orphan's End. Spoilers?
Yeah.
This is the end of Cyclops being an orphan.
I suppose it is.
Yeah.
This is another Cyclops backstory episode. We've had I'd say we'd have one solid one before and sort of some half-sprinkled backstory moments for him previously.
Right.
In the Phoenix Saga.
Those were just teasers, though.
Yeah, there's teasers. And, like, his fiancée, Jean, like, knows the truth, and she doesn't tell him in a few episodes.
Right.
She's like, I can never tell Scott this, that Corsair is his father. That was very much in the Phoenix Saga.
Right, but it's like, why not? Like,
yeah, you're his closest intimate person in his entire life.
Right.
Why are you keeping that a secret from him?
Yeah.
And which brings up the conversation I think we had previously in that podcast about a woman's heart being a chamber of secrets. A message we learned in Titanic. I think maybe I saw these X-Men episodes first as a kid, and then when I saw Titanic in 1997...
It all made sense.
Yeah, they finally explained why Gene wouldn't tell Scott all these horrible secrets about himself.
Uh-huh.
Well, they're not horrible, but, you know. And the other episode we saw this season... well, not really this season, because it was imported from Season 5, was No Mutant is an Island. That's another Cyclops backstory episode.
Right.
Where we learn about his days growing up in an orphanage, sort of.
Right.
And his troubled childhood as a mutant.
So wait, when this was aired, would we have seen that episode?
No, we would not have. This would have been a better Cyclops origin introduction episode than the No Mutant is an Island, which is a pretty bad episode overall.
Right.
But technically, they wanted two Cyclops origin episodes in Season 3. The mystery of Cyclops needed to be revealed to the children. So here's another one. I'd say this episode's pretty good.
It's pretty convoluted to me. But, like, it's an interesting story, and there's a lot of interesting characters. I always like it when there's these other groups of mutants, whether it's the Starjammers or the Shi'ar or, like...
Well, they're not necessarily
mutants.
They're not
mutants. They
might have powers,
they're aliens,
though.
But, you know, like, I like when all those other groups make an appearance. To me, this episode was, like, extra convoluted because I'm not too familiar with all the members of those other groups, and when you have more than one of the groups at the same time, like, they all get a little jumbled for me, and like a little hard for me to follow, like, who's on what side.
It's not even just that, it's that the plot was very jumbled and confusing. It almost seems like there's stuff cut out of the script that they had to edit out
for time or
something. There's just stuff going on with the weird backstory of why Corsair is back on Earth and why all the parties are separated, and there's some
Corsair,
otherwise known as Major Christopher Summers, Cyclops's long lost father. This is a convoluted episode. I liked it, though, because it's got that snappy, like, fast-paced action
that we know
and love about the X-Men. It's not... Because some of the episodes have their action scenes, but they're kind of clunky and poorly staged.
Mm-hmm.
This is not one of those. This is one where ships are flying, you know, dramatically, and laser beams are exploding forest, and people are hopping into underground monorail systems, and then they're crashing on the other side of the Earth somewhere in Mexico.
Yeah,
so,
it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like the camera moves really beautifully in this episode, and the action's well clipped.
Right. And like I was saying, the different characters that are introduced in these battles are, like, really interesting characters, even if you don't know who all of them are.
Yeah, it's just hard to... There's so much going on, it's hard to pay attention to what's going on with the plot. And so, essentially, like we've discussed, this is the episode where Corsair returns to Earth and Cyclops finds out for real that this guy is his long-lost father.
Right.
Like you said, the episode's titled Orphan's End. But we really, it's not like an episode like you think it would be where it's Corsair and Cyclops going out, you know, to lunch and discussing their lives and, like, all their, like,
that
adventures.
That doesn't sound like a great plot device for, like, a kid's show.
Yeah, for a kid's show, no. But for me, it's like if I was doing the adult X-Men HBO show, which has always been my secret dream.
Not so secret,
When the character Cyclops meets Corsair, it'd probably be more of, like, a psychological episode.
More, like, dialogue-driven.
Right, where, like, this guy, you know, he returns to Earth for the first time in 20 years, and that alone is interesting. Yeah. Like the fact that Corsair at the okay, let's jump to the end. Corsair at the end's like, all right, I gotta go. And Cyclops is like, why don't you stay a while? We can have a chat.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, I guess you twisted my arm.
Right.
It's like, first of all, you don't want to hang out with your long-lost son who
you haven't seen in 20 years.
Yeah, there's that. But beyond that, it's like, you haven't really been back to Earth where you've been violently kidnapped from. And you don't want to, like, you know, get a pizza or something.
Well, he has this fabulous new life flying around outer space. Maybe Earth is old news to him and he doesn't care about it anymore.
Yeah, I agree, but that's kind of bizarre to me.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, the fact that outer space is that much better than Earth, where you've got family still.
It's more bizarre to me that he needs to be convinced to, like, stay and talk to his son.
But also the fact that his other son is still alive, Alex,
yeah,
who we just met in the last episode,
right,
who bizarrely Cyclops doesn't know is his brother as an adult, yet in this episode he establishes that he's aware Alex is alive and he knows who Alex is as a person.
Right, but he doesn't know
that like
he's Havoc.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like the implication is that they got split up in orphanages in this universe, right, which I think is like partially true in the comics too. But I think in the comics, and I mentioned this in the last episode, and someone out there has to correct me if I'm wrong, that Cyclops and Havoc are aware of each other when they meet for the first time. That might be wrong, but they like do know of each other.
But this is an age before internets.
Yeah.
So finding someone, a long-lost relative, isn't easy.
I know, but
you'd have to hire a private investigator or something at that time. Who knows how they got their information? I don't know. It's plausible to me.
It's just, you know, you would think also that there would have been a scene we didn't see in the last episode where the X-Men meet the X-Factor.
Yeah.
Where at the end, Forge is introducing the characters. And maybe one of them is like, oh, your name is Scott Summers. This guy's Alex Summers. You guys kind of look alike. Are you guys related?
Right.
You're both mutants and your powers don't work on each other.
And you have the same last
like
name.
You think that one of them would make the connection, and we just didn't see that scene.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that happens. It almost seems like the X-Men hastily leave the X-Factor group to bring Iceman back to the X-Mansion.
Well,
yeah, it's weird. There's something going on in the X-Men TAS universe about the division between Havoc and Cyclops that I don't think is ever explored.
Okay.
And this episode certainly does not build a bridge into explaining it either.
Right.
All right. So
you want to start us off here?
Yeah, let's go through it a little bit.
Now that we've been rambling for 10 minutes.
Well, but this is like like you said, it's a convoluted, bizarre episode with a lot of action. So, you know, we're going to go through it, but it's almost like there's not that much to talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some funny things that happen along the way. For starters, Storm's got a ponytail out of nowhere.
Yeah, I like Storm's ponytail. It's cool.
You like it? You think that suits, you know, like her big poof of wavy hair?
I mean, I like that too, but, you know, we always like seeing a new look from the X-Men.
Well, and with this, we're going to see some new hairstyles from Storm 2 coming up, I believe, in the start of Season 4 as well. That'll be interesting. Yeah, I mean, Storm, historically in the comics, always had a bunch of different hairstyles.
Uh-huh.
So it's, you know, you're right. It's nice to see her, like, they're finally, like, giving her a different look. And, you know, she's hanging out with Cyclops. They're drinking coffee in the X-Mansion. And they get an emergency broadcast from a Shi'ar ship asking them to assist in capturing a, like, renegade starship, which turns out to be the Starjammer.
Do you remember the name of the guy on the Shi'ar ship?
It's like Ragnar or something, or Ragnar, I don't know.
Whatever it is, he's animated with crazy eyeballs that like move around, and they're like really big. Yeah. But I really like the voice acting from that guy. I don't know if it's the same voice actor that does one of the other characters.
I'm sure
whatever,
it is. They, very, they use like, their own stable of voice actors.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's very like deep and gravelly and like distinctive and kind of crazy.
Do it?
No, I can't.
Cyclops, we need your assistance. Is that close or not?
No.
Really? Yeah, I didn't do a good job. Okay, whatever. I tried. So he contacts the X-Men. He needs their help because I guess the Shi'ar and X-Men are allies now. And it's just like this is all going on while there's this bizarre chase scene over planet Earth. Like the Starjammer is skimming, you know, like an airport at one point, and then it's blowing through New York City, and it kind of ends up crash landing coincidentally of all places, like just outside the X-Mansion in Westchester, New York.
But is it coincidental? He knows what the X-Mansion is when he's coming up on it.
Yeah, maybe. You're right. Yeah.
So I think he's going there on purpose. Yeah.
He's looking for his help. Okay. But it's also just weird that there's like, this is an intergalactic space battle going on, like, you know, a few miles above, like, not even, like, a few thousand feet above the Earth's surface, with laser beams blasting off and, like, people nearly getting killed on the ground. And where is the U.S. military?
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, well, you know, this is like a pre-9/11 world where America was, in the 90s, America was sort of at peace, more or less, and there's a relaxed military posture.
Or they're, like, super advanced intergalactic vessels with, like, extreme cloaking abilities.
That's probably more likely what it is. But even still, you would, there would be reports of these explosions and spaceships going off, and you would think that jets would be scrambled somewhere. And, like, later we see, like, again, to jump to the end of the episode, the Starjammer is just parked in front of the X-Mansion. And you can't... It's, like, not discreet at all. You can't have an interstellar spaceship just parked in, like, a public space...
In front of a school.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Like, the military... Like, we've discussed in the show, the police and the military are just not involved in the X-Men's business, not nearly as much as you think they would be.
It's one of those suspension of belief things.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah. I mean, even, like, with the government has a Sentinel program, and they just had no problem with, like, 20-story robots stomping around, you know, downtown Salem Center or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. So that was worth noting, Storm's ponytail and the lack of military presence. and then, like, the Starjammer crashes in a lake, Cyclops jumps in to save Corsair, who seems to be the only guy in there. The other Starjammers are not present at the time being. Corsair's crew, and Storm helps them out with, like, a typhoon.
Whirlpool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how that was helpful at the time.
She makes, like, a tornado to help, like, raise the ship up out of the water so Cyclops can get him out of it before it, like, becomes flooded.
Right. And, okay, yeah, so that sort of makes sense. Mm-hmm. And, here... You know, Cyclops, like, grabs Corsair's dog tags and also, like, a pendant on his neck. And he sees that he's carrying a locket with a picture of Scott, his brother Alex, and his mother in it. And he's completely stunned and shocked by this.
Yeah.
He's like, who are you? How could you have this?
Yeah, he's like, this is my family. What do you mean it's your family?
He's like, I'm Major Christopher Summers. He's like, what? That's my father's name.
Yeah.
And then right at that moment, the Shi'ar ship comes to arrest Corsair. And Cyclops, it's pretty funny. He's like, I need a minute. Yeah. I need to talk to this guy. It's like, and they're like, you're an enemy now, Cyclops. You're helping him. And so Cyclops is forced to sort of bail out Corsair. And it's kind of weird that Cyclops has not much love for Corsair in the first place, because Corsair is pretty instrumental in the whole Phoenix saga. And he's like, oh, you're a criminal now. I guess I'll turn you over to the space police.
Uh-huh.
And he's not, like, at all even willing to listen to Corsair's side. He's got, like, no loyalty to him whatsoever.
Well, he's angry at him. This guy, like, left him for 20
years.
No,
but this is almost, like, right before that, I'm saying. He's, like, ready to turn him over. He's fully compliant with the Shi'ar police.
Right.
Cyclops is an ultimate, like, authority bootlicker, despite his own stance as, like, a sort of a renegade, like, paramilitary, you know, vigilante in his own right. He really loves, like, chains of command. And
yeah, totally. That's, like, really well-established, you know? He's, like, a teacher's pet to Charles Xavier.
Yeah. But isn't that funny, though, that he's, like, a teacher's pet? He really loves authority. He loves following rules and order. And he's extremely moral, too.
Yeah.
He's, like, got such a clear, right and wrong, you know, tapestry to himself. He really knows, like the difference between good and bad. Like, to a very, like, honed degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, he, at one point in the Starjammer episode earlier in the season when it's the Phoenix Saga, he's talking about how he, like, he'll refuse to kill in cold blood even if it's an emperor that threatens to kill trillions, because his, like, moral compass is so, like, he actually says he will do it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't feel good about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
He's, like, Cyclops is, like, a real, like, Captain America-esque superhero in a lot of ways. He's got, like, a very similar personality.
Agreed.
But, like, the interesting shading is that he's part of the X-Men, which are a real, like I said, sort of vigilante, like, taking the law into their own hands, mutants, like, secret underground mutant defense force.
Right.
You know, and mutants themselves are, like, borderline illegal sometimes in the X-Men universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's just weird that his personality type exists in a culture that's, like, more, like on the side of Wolverine than on the side of, you know, like Lieutenant Joe Johnson of the Westchester Police Force. You know,
yeah,
that's
totally.
What he acts like. Yeah,
I'm always surprised when you say that he's your favorite character. I know there's the glasses connection for you, which
that's
is
a lot to do with it.
Whatever, but like because his personality is like that. You know, he's so like straight laced in his thinking and stuff. To me, like when I watched him as a kid, I always was like, ugh, come on, this guy.
I mean, that's most people's reaction. I think a lot of it had to do with the glasses, to be honest. And I thought his power looked cool. And I like that he had Jean Grey as his girlfriend.
Such superficial reasoning.
Yeah, it was. It's totally. So I'm saying, like, as an adult, I've grown to see the faults of Cyclops and can see how he's, like, super lame and a real honky, you know, of the, like, highest magnitude. But at the same time, that being said, there is a lot more to his character than just the superficial things that people dislike about him, that he is straight-laced and Wolverine clowns on him. There's, like, so much more that went on in the comics with his, like, backstory is really interesting, as we kind of see in this episode. He's got, there's, like, a lot of angles to him. The pressure he's under as being the leader of the X-Men is always, like, really interesting, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that he's the leader of this group of, like, otherwise, like, complete, like, punky rebels that are all, like, have super strong personalities.
But are him and Storm supposed to be equals?
They're, like, at this era of, like, in the comic books, which they sort of translate to the cartoon in, like, a, like, semi-awkward way, they're like, co-leaders of different teams. So he's the leader of the blue team, and she's the leader of the gold team.
Right.
But, and, like, and they've shared leadership roles throughout the past, too, in different ways as well. Like, Storm usurped him in the comics at one point.
Mm.
After Jean dies, Storm sort of, like,
she has to take over because he has a mental breakdown.
Yeah, but, like, she has to challenge him in the danger room, and she beats him without her powers, and he still has his powers.
Right.
And when he gets licked by Storm, he, like, agrees, like, I'm not good enough to be an X-Men anymore, and he leaves for a while.
Right.
So, you know, like, they've, like, gone back and forth with leadership roles, and
I
like in the show that they are kind of co-leaders. It's kind of nice and progressive in a way.
This episode in particular is interesting because they're the only two X-Men that appear in it. There's no Xavier. There's no other members of the X-Men team.
Oh, yeah, it's interesting, yeah.
And, like, so they're the two, like, co-leaders of the X-Men that are featuring in this episode. And, like, he, I mean, we'll get there, but, like, he kind of, like, orders her around in some instances because, like, this is his storyline.
He just seems to have, you're right, he seems to have slightly more authority than her.
But it might just be, like, this scenario, you know?
It might be this scenario, yeah, she's deferring to him.
It's his father and his, like, problems that he got them into.
Yeah, I think we've seen that dynamic before between the X-Men, where they'll kind of defer to whoever's, like, got the main storyline.
Yeah.
They let them take charge. Because there's a lot of the storylines are about, like, action around an emotional revelation.
Right.
You know, be it with, like, Rogue's, like, adopted parents or something, you know, with Mystique and things of that, or Gambit, you know.
Yeah, they're all, like, watching that one person to, like, take their lead.
And other times it's, like, when the leader, the emotional leader of the storyline, they often also get reined in by the other X-Men. It's like, I know what's best for you. I'm going to pull you back, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you can't do this or something. Like, whatever. We've seen that before, too.
Right.
I think that was, like, in the Gambit episode. Well, not the Gambit episode. It was the episode with Archangel getting his revenge on Apocalypse, and Rogue really wanted to help him, and Gambit had to pull Rogue back for her own good.
Yeah.
You know, he was like, I know what's best for you, Rogue. Like, don't do this.
Teamwork and friendship.
Yeah, but also kind of, like, patronizing. And,
yeah.
You know, that kind of aspect, too.
Yeah.
So, right. So there's, like, that's another cool thing about this episode. We get that, like, subtle, like, relationship between Cyclops and Storm. They're really good partners in a way. They have a lot of an unspoken respect for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And also going back to, like, why Cyclops is my favorite character or was, it's, I think he, like, there's something about him getting shit on in the movies too.
Mm.
He was never really given his full due.
So you feel like even though he's, like, the straight-laced, like, leader of the team, he's, like, kind of the underdog in a way.
There's that aspect, and there's just more to it with him. I mean, it's just, there's something about, like, the X-Men. So much of why the X-Men are interesting is because of the character that he is and the role he plays in the team. And he's very much involved. For as boring as he is in a way, he's also very much involved in all the soap operas.
Yeah.
With the romances and stuff. And
right.
So, you know, the funny thing, though, about rewatching this show is that I've come to the conclusion that I think Wolverine really should be the leader. And the way they sort of, like, corner Wolverine and restrain him is bullshit. Because he's got, like, the most experience you know, he's lived for like almost two centuries or whatever it is, you know.
But
like
they don't trust his leadership because he's kind of a loose cannon sometimes.
But is he, like, he's also the most brave and also the most noble-hearted, I feel, at times, too. And he's not an idiot. Like, they really established in the show, and it's also established in the comics, Wolverine is smart as hell.
He, like, it's in knows the video game, too, isn't it? Like, they give stats on all the... He can be, like, Nightcrawler.
Oh, yeah.
He's normal. Scott Summers is, like, normal intelligence.
Yeah.
And, like, Wolverine's the
above
only one.
Above average.
Yeah.
So, we were playing the Genesis X-Men video game, which people always want us to talk about, but I don't really know what to say other than, like, remember the X-Men Genesis game? You know, it was fun. The music was cool, right? We were just playing that the other day. We got an SNES Classic, and we modded it to put Genesis games and arcade games on there. We put the X-Men arcade game on there, and we put X-Men vs. Street Fighter, and it's been really awesome. And by the way, Cal Dodd's voice is in those X-Men Street Fighter games, which is really cool.
Yeah.
I think Norm Spencer, the guy who does Cyclops, is in some of them, but I might be wrong on that. Anyway, diversion aside, when you're looking at the stats of the X-Men characters in the Genesis game, like Sunny said, Wolverine's the only one with above-average intelligence. Everyone else has average intelligence, which is, I think, is inaccurate. Nightcrawler and Gambit might have average intelligence. That's one thing. But Cyclops, I think, probably has above-average intelligence. If only because he knows how to, like, frickin' fly the Blackbird and, like...
Oh, I thought you were going to say because he wears glasses.
Oh, no. Well, he's like a tactical leader of the team. He's like smart,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
He's not dumb.
Yeah.
He's not average. And but anyway, the point is, like, however smart you think Cyclops is, Wolverine is definitely as smart, if not smarter, in my opinion.
So you're making the case that Wolverine should be the leader.
I'm saying he has got a lot of qualities of, like, him, like, yeah, he should be the leader. And in the movies, they make him the leader by default because he's the coolest character and they kill off Cyclops. But that's not, like, why he would be the leader. That's kind of just stupid, like, Hugh Jackman is a star kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so... And he's not the leader right away, but he kind of just takes over that role.
But the thing about Wolverine being a loose cannon, it's not like he makes, like, immoral decisions or anything like that. It's more, he sometimes just, like, drops everything and leaves at a moment's notice.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, got to drive my truck back to Canada now. See you guys in 10 years or whatever.
I guess, but I feel like all the X-Men do that at different times.
Yeah.
They're all got the element of being insane loners to them. And they're all ready to leave at a moment's notice. I mean, like, and that even happens to Cyclops, for as much as he gets annoyed when Wolverine leaves. He also leaves at times. In the No Mutant Asylum episode, I think the whole premise was he has to leave. I mean, Jean Grey just died, but he does quit. You know, and that happens in the comics a bunch. But then Wolverine in the comics, he does become the leader at some point of, like, the more good-hearted X-Men. Like, there's a split in the more modern comics. Cyclops forms, like, this more, like, radical mutant group that is, like, borderline evil. I don't really know what the deal was. And then Wolverine becomes, like, the leader of the Xavier Institute. Or actually, it's changed to, like, the Jean Grey school.
Because
Xavier is also, like, this wild card that they don't believe in anymore.
Yeah.
Like, everything gets very mixed up the more you get into the 2000s. But, like I said, in watching the show, I just feel that Wolverine gets, like, disrespected too much for all that he brings to the table, you know? And, like, the fact that he's, like, way braver, and the X-Men, like, really wimp out a lot of times, and he's, like, really willing to, like, risk it all to save the day.
Okay.
He, like, out-superheroes these fine collection of superheroes. Okay, so that was a long divergent tangent. That's always fun. all right, so now back to this episode. Another, like, ridiculous thing where Storm shouts out of nowhere... when they're escaping the Shi'ar, she's like, I shall meet you at the monorail.
Yeah, and when we both were watching the episode, we're like, what monorail?
And then it turns out that I guess Professor X built this elaborate underground monorail system in the greater Westchester area, you know, in upstate New York.
For his own private use.
Yeah, for the X-Men's own private use that I guess they used to. I mean, it was convenient here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like, you know, Batman has the Batcave, which is very impressive with all the stuff he fits under there. You know, but Professor Xavier rivals him for all the junk he's got going underneath his house, too. In fact, it's like, that's like a massive ripoff of Batman, is the underground layer aspect of the X-Mansion. You know, it's the same thing.
So what?
I'm just saying, I never, like, thought about it until this moment. Like, I'm just saying, like, it's a complete, like, it's the exact same thing. They've got a mansion.
Yeah, you
just
have,
like,
to keep it hidden. Where else are you going to put it?
I mean, I think, all right.
Otherwise, you rip off, like, the Fortress of Solitude idea or something, right?
Well, Fortress of Solitude's in, like, a separate location. That's not underneath Metropolis.
I know, that's what I'm saying. It's, like, either you make it, like, underground so it's hidden, or you put it in a very remote location.
I'm just going to say that, like, the idea, when the X-Men originally started off in the 60s, they did their training inside the house.
Right.
whether or not the Danger Room, which was introduced, is in the quote-unquote basement at the time, I'm not sure. But the Danger Room was initially, it was just a big, like, rec room with, like flamethrowers and saws that come out of the ground.
Yeah.
It didn't need to be underground because it was a secret. It was just, like, where they put it.
Right.
And I don't even know if it was underground. So my point is, like, the idea that, like, all the secret military op stuff, like, got moved, quote-unquote, underground, I think happened slowly over time.
Well, because they got more advanced technology that took up more room that
right.
was
they
more
had,
and more
had,
secret.
Had because, to hide the jet. Yeah. But, like, it just, I'm just saying, it's just funny how it turned out that it, whether it was intentional or not, it ended up being a ripoff of Batman, consciously or subconsciously. And that might just speak to more of, like, a trope of comic books. Like you said, like, practically, where are you going to put all this stuff?
Yeah, I don't think it's a ripoff. I think it's, where else are you going to put it? It's
right.
Practical.
Okay, ripoff is the wrong word. I mean, it's just, like I said, it's in the world of comics that these things tend to happen. And it's kind of like funny, you know, like you said, because there's like a practical reason.
Yeah.
Okay, so fine. All right, that's interesting. So he's got an underground monorail system.
Yeah.
And of course, I can't help but think of like monorails and cartoons in the 90s and also think of The Simpsons, which.
Yeah.
There's a whole episode about monorails, which is funny. So, you know, and like the other thing to note in this episode, as like Corsair is like slowly revealing what happened to Cyclops between all the action beats, Cyclops, his emotions keep vacillating from like insanely outraged to calm and intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't know how to feel, and we've seen that, like we saw that in the last episode too. His emotions are like way out of whack lately. In the last episode with Iceman,
he lost his one true love.
Well, yeah, but she's okay now. She's recovering. Yeah. But in the last episode, we saw him just like losing his shit at the thought of even helping Bobby Drake, Iceman.
Yeah.
He's just out of his mind. And in this episode, he's like that too at times, just screaming in Corsair's face, mm-hmm. his dad, and other times saying it's like, I, you know, you saved us all to, you know,
it's a real roller coaster of emotions, you know,
yeah.
like
that's right, yeah.
his dad like resurfaces and he's like, but I'm helping a fugitive.
Yeah, yeah.
But I risked everything for you.
Yeah.
But I haven't spoken to you in 20 years.
But I must protect the law because kidnapping is wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you might be a murderer. And you might be a thief or
right.
something.
And I gave you my last parachute.
Right. right. Yeah, they should have called this episode...
The Last Burning Parachute?
That or... Yeah, that's funny. Or Roller Coaster of Emotions, like he said. Okay, so, you know, that's all going on. Cyclops is being very... It's hard to... That's why it's hard to be an X-Man, because the amount of emotions you have to cycle through while you're consequently, like, doing backflips and using your mutant powers and trying to save the day, it's very taxing.
Mm.
You know, like...
I would imagine.
I've always talking about, like, how sweaty they are at the end of a mission in those skin-tight uniforms. It just can't be easy. And then we get, like, a little bit more... Like, we get to see the traditional Cyclops backstory scene that's been hinted at before in the show, but they show it explicitly, and it's pretty much straight from the comics, that Cyclops' father was like a pilot in Alaska, and he was flying his family around, and the Shi'ar spaceship came out of nowhere to kidnap them for God knows why, and so he gives Scott and Alex the last parachute. They jump out. The parachute, like you said, is burning on fire, so he doesn't know if they live or die. And then the mother and Corsair are transported to the Shi'ar ship. The mother is killed at some point by Deken, the evil emperor of the Shi'ar, who the X-Men later tangled with in the Phoenix Saga and got rid of. And then Corsair, because he thinks he has no family left, decides to become like a space pirate and roam the galaxy.
Yeah.
So we get to see all that. Why are you looking at me so crazy?
That was a mad recap, but totally true.
Yeah, mad recap. And then
my most favorite part of that whole entire thing was when the Shi'ar transport Corsair and the mom onto their ship.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as we mentioned, we've been watching a lot of Star Trek because it's cold and we can't go outside.
Right.
And their transport technology that the Shi'ar have is like, it's like beaming from Star Trek, except it's like... They become like sparkly galaxy.
Ooh, yeah, it's
goo
nice.
Or something.
Much like the cosmic Marvel Force Eternity, who
yeah,
we've
exactly.
seen on a recent episode. We like that effect.
Yeah.
And related to Star, I feel like Chris Claremont or whoever the Shi'ar were probably ripped off Star Trek in some way. You know, and it was done in the 1970s, late uh-huh. early 80s.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Star Trek going on with the Shi'ar. We see with their like command hierarchies inside the ship and the way they beam people and they advance. They've got like multi alien species serving under them. You know, like red alligators too and.
Yeah.
You know, so they are, it's very Star Trek-esque.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
To begin with, yeah. So, you know, so we get the whole Cyclops backstory, the traditional backstory. There's even more to it in the comics, that there's also a third Summers child. I forget where he comes from. But, you know, he plays in a role at some leader.
Like, we didn't see that in this.
No, that episode, doesn't happen though, in this cartoon. That happens, like, in the, like, 2000s. That's introduced that there's another Summers. Mm. It might have been a half-brother of the other Summers kids. Mm-hmm. And he's, like, he's supposed to even be more powerful than Cyclops and Havok. Mm. I don't know his full story, but it's kind of interesting that, like, it's always funny. It's, like, it's when you're these comic book writers, whenever you've got a traditional backstory, it's almost like they if to keep adding to the story, they see like these invisible escape hatches of narrative that we can't see. Uh-huh. It's like, yeah, so for years the backstory has been the Summer's dad has been kidnapped by the Shi'ar. It's like, why wasn't there another kid along the way too? Like, that could have happened, you know what I mean? It's like, you thought the full story was told, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
And that's just done in every comic book, you know, like that they'll take something you know that's familiar. Like, and I'm totally making this up right now, but you could say like, you know, when Bruce Wayne's parents were killed in the alley, his dad secretly survived all these years and was like, and I think that was like sort of a weird plot line that Thomas Wayne lived and became his own vigilante. I don't know. I really am not like the biggest Batman expert, but there's something that happened where his like dad lived and became a villain or something. Mm. And something with like the Court of Owls. I have no fucking clue what I'm talking about, but like I sort of do. So like, but that's my point. Like you could just take these like well-worn, like classic stories, like, Superman's dad died on Krypton, or did he? You know, that kind of thing. Like, Krypton was destroyed, or was it? You know,
it's just funny because that's pretty standard in the world of comic books, because if you want to keep the comic going, you have to expand the universe in different ways and still connect it back to the story that everyone knows and loves.
But, yeah,
and it's, like, accepted when it's done in a comic book run.
Right.
But that's what every, like, TV writer and movie writer does, too. And, like, that is not accepted.
It's not. It's a little. It's harder to go after. In the comics, it's more fun to go after a sacred cow. Because it's kind of, like, weirdly rewarding to the comic reader. Because the comic reader knows more about the finer details than the casual fan does.
Yeah.
So when they go back to Bruce Wayne's murder and they do a twist, it could enrage the comic reader, too. Don't get me wrong. But it could also be something that, it's like, if it's done well, it's intriguing. Mm-hmm. And most times when they, like, fuck up, like, messing up a sacred cow, they go back and fix it in some way to satisfy. Oh, it was a parallel dimension, and they were clones. They were robots. You know, it wasn't what you thought it was.
Yeah,
You know, they've done that with Captain America, where he was evil recently. Like they said, oh, he's been working for Hydra this whole time,
right?
And like it made actual news headlines that Captain America was a Nazi. This like, you know, a secret agent, and then but then it turned out that he was a clone or a robot or something, or from a parallel dimension. The real Steve Rogers returned to reclaim the Captain America mantle.
Yeah,
and then sometimes they do it like in a way that pisses off fans or the original writers, like when they brought Jean Grey back to life.
Right.
She was supposed to be dead, and they like, you know, when they made X-Factor, like we discussed in the last episode in the comics, Jean Grey, they wanted her back for the original five team members that consisted of X-Factor at the time. So they brought her back to life in some dumb way, saying that like the Phoenix was cloned Jean Grey and put her body in like a tube in the bottom of the ocean. Mm. She was alive this whole time, but it's like, it, like none of it makes sense. And like, and that was like one that like pissed off a lot of fans, I think, too, because it, like, ruined the Jean Grey storyline. And then they also, they made her the Phoenix in the end anyway, years later.
Yeah.
And she, like, kept dying and living.
She should have just lived well enough alone. But
yeah, yeah.
I'm just saying, in general, like, the comic book runs that go off on tangents like that have a much higher success rate because it becomes accepted as canon, you know, whereas, like, the random TV shows and
I see
movies
you're saying.
And stuff.
Yeah, they like, piss people off.
Yeah.
Because they have to, the thing is, like, I think fans have this desire. They want to see it get done right in the first place before you go back and, like, fuck it up. It's like, why are you fucking it up right away if this is supposed to be the first time we're meeting the character?
Yeah.
Like, the details were – the whole point of why – I mean, this is, like, a sort of a fight between fans and these new, like, movie and TV creators. Is it's like – the fans are always saying the message, the comics got it right the first time. This is why we love the comic and want to see it on the big screen. You're disrespecting the thing we love in the first place by screwing it all up.
Right.
Now, sometimes they screw it up and it's good. Like, in my opinion, in Iron Man 3 with the Mandarin. Mm. You can't have a character called the Mandarin in this day and age. Like, that's basically a racist, like, caricature of, like, Asian stereotypes that was something to do with the Vietnam War, you know, when it was created at the time, you know, like, because at the time, like, you know, the Orient was bad kind of thing. Mm. Like, America's enemy. You can't have that today and be taken seriously. So they take – but he was, like, Iron Man's number one villain for many years.
Right.
And so what they do is, like, they turn it on its head and it's all like a joke, you know?
Right.
And that was clever. So when you do stuff like that, that's like really cool. But like when you do stuff, I don't know, and this is like a real small thing that I've nitpicked before, when you like, when you did X-Men First Class and the team you choose is like different than the original team, it kind of bothers me in some weird way, where like you make Havoc older than Cyclops.
I think it's all about,
I mean, that's fine, like, but it's like whatever.
Directors trying to like put their own creative stamp on things when the original fans of whatever series it is don't want to see a new creative stamp.
I think they would be, they're not against a new creative stamp as long as you get the setup right and you pay homage to the thing that, you know, in the first place. They want to, they made this point on Red Letter Media recently, we're big fans of that, where they were talking about like how the new Star Trek show Discovery is real divisive to fans because they alter, there's details about the show where the show is claimed to be in continuity 10 years before Kirk and Spock, but there's things about the show that are anachronisms, like that all the technology is way more advanced than what we see in the 1960s Star Trek. So fans get a little annoyed, and then they like change details around about the Klingons, the way they look and talk and things like that, right? So, but the thing is, like, fans want to know that their original stories that they're invested in, that the continuity is preserved somehow. But when you kind of shit all over the continuity in a way, but say, oh, it's still part of the continuity, it like, it irks fans the wrong way, because like, well, we were invested in all these stories, and now you're telling me that like, not to believe in all these details that I believed in. And people, and they say, it's like, why do you make that, fans might say, like, why do you make that choice when all you had to do is just like keep it in line with what we had before, and I would be willing to accept like this new story you're telling me. So it's like this tough like tightrope between like trying to like update stuff for a new audience, like make stuff like make logical sense in the modern day, but then also like not like pissing off the fans who are going to be there in the first place that pay attention to all that stuff in the past and need it to like still make sense today. So it's like, it's weird, it's like,
it's a hard job,
it's a hard job, it's hard to do, it's, you can't satisfy everyone. And you have to, as a fan, be willing to like go along with the creative choices. I think most fans that like have a sense of good taste, which I'd like to think me and you do, like, we're willing to go along with a radical change as long as the story's logical, the acting is good, the writing is good, you know, and the direction's good. Like, we're willing, as long as, like, it's presented, like, passionately and done well, then it's like, yeah, change around, who cares? You know, we get it. It's just pop culture. It's like, meant to be fucked with. But when you're not doing a good job on any one of those things, or like, all of them, and the end product sucks, and you've changed it all too on top of it, then it's annoying. It's like, it was one thing that Justice League or Batman vs. Superman were bad movies. It's another thing that you like then like go on top of it and like fuck up all the characterizations of the characters too and say like, this is what Batman's like, he's a murderer now, and Superman's this like loner weirdo, you know. It's like, but that's not what they were. If you just at least established that they're Batman and Superman were who we traditionally knew who they're supposed to be, but then you make a bad movie, I think that's more forgivable than making a bad movie plus like telling us that Batman now uses machine guns to kill people. You know, it's like, that's like the, that's like
insult,
a slap in the face.
Injury.
Yes.
All right.
So back to this episode. Is there even much to say? I mean, there's like some plot line with this kidnapped Shi'ar girl named Chandra who's a witness to a murder, and Corsair's like been hired to save her, and he's been promised money to help do it too. And Cyclops is annoyed when he hears about the money, but then it turns out that Corsair was doing the right thing all along anyway. And this Shi'ar guy who's after Corsair was in league with his Lord Chamberlain to cover up a murder. It's all been a big setup plot. So Corsair turns out to be a good guy in the end. They crash into the like step pyramids.
The Mayan pyramids.
Yeah, the Mayan pyramids in South America at some point, like destroying them. You know, that's pretty sad. In like a casually thrown off way. Another Earth.
That someone's hiding out there. Was it the Shi'ar? Yeah, the Shi'ar were hiding out in like one of those pyramids in like Mexico or Guatemala or something.
It's even hard to pay attention to it at that point. It was like so much stuff was happening.
So that's the scene of one of their battles.
It's another Earth monument destroyed. I think, didn't Apocalypse knock over the Eiffel Tower we saw in a previous episode? Yes. It's like the landmarks of planet Earth are not safe in the X-Men universe. So that happens at some point, and there's another funny line that I saw where someone asks Cyclops, the Starjammers, they've been there the whole time, hiding out in the jungles too. They meet the X-Men again, we meet our old pals Chode and the Cat Lady and the other characters. I don't remember all their names. And someone asks Cyclops, are you not Corsair's son? And he's like, not by choice. And it's like, well, geez, you know, Cyclops, nobody's any child by choice. You're kind of forced to accept whoever your parents are. But whatever. you know, he's real emo in that moment. Did anything else happen of note in this episode? I mean, then, like we said, it ends where Cyclops has to twist his dad's arm to stay on Earth for a little while so he can chat.
What ends up happening with the Shi'ar? I can't even remember.
I think they're dealt with. They rescue the witness. Yeah, I don't even remember what happens to
them. They reconcile it in some way. They explain what's going on, that it was, I don't know what.
Yeah, the sub-commander, I think, of the ship takes control and sets things right in some way and joins efforts with Corsair. Uh-huh. Right, I don't even pay. It was too convoluted, honestly. And it's not, it's like, this is like a real slight episode. It looked well, it had great action, it was interesting, it was well acted.
Yep.
But it was just too, like
the
crazy
nuances of that plot line.
Yeah, there's things that were edited out for time that just didn't make sense. And it was an episode that, like, not even really connected with the main X-Men storyline as well, so.
I guess, like, the main idea of it was, like, Cyclops and Corsair reunite and know who the other one is, and
that's
how we end up.
And then there's, like, a funny line at the very end where Corsair's talking about Cyclops' fiancée, who's Jean, and he's like, oh, yeah, she's in recovery. And he's like, you know, she reminds me of your mother. But he says, maybe I should wait to tell you about that until after you're married. And
yeah, dun dun dun.
Well, it's like, what? What are you implying there? Like, one that, first of all, you're assuming that Cyclops is a virgin and he hasn't slept with Jean, which might be possible on the show, by the way. And we only say that based on talking to Eric and Julia Leewald, the X-Men writers, where they said that they couldn't have Jean pregnant because they, something to do with, like, that would imply that they had sex.
Right.
But the other thing is, like, that implication also meant that they couldn't have sex until after they got married, too, which was bizarre. So,
I mean, that's the way things are done for, like,
a lot of people. I know.
Many people.
Yeah, but Scott and Jean don't seem like ardent Catholics or something, or, you know.
They have to keep it, you know, quote unquote, like, family friendly.
But that's beyond family friendly. That's almost, like, religious family friendly. It's so unrealistic to assume that
But it's a kids' show. Like,
I know.
You know.
I know, and this was, like, the 90s, but I think if this was done
when you're
now,
7, you don't know about that.
I agree, but still.
And they're not trying to introduce 7-year-olds to that concept.
I know.
That's not the point of this show.
But that's what's making this joke even more weird to me. it's almost like they're bringing it to our attention.
So you think it's like a joke for the adults that are watching along with their kids on Saturday morning, or you think it's just like a throwaway for like the writers to entertain themselves?
I think it's a throwaway joke that it's meant to go over the heads of kids. I don't think it's for their parents. I think it's just it's a joke that is, like I said, is to kids. This is an adult joke that you're not going to understand really, but like you sort of do. Beyond that, I'm just curious, like, what is Corsair saying, though, by making that joke? Like, she reminds me of your mother, but I have to tell you until after you're married. So does he mean that, like, his mom... Because he's also talking about how she's a fiery redhead.
Uh-huh.
So, what does he say?
I don't think he...
Is it like a carpet matches the drapes joke? Is that what he's saying?
I don't think so.
It's not that?
Like, I thought it was more like... He's like, oh, she reminds me of your mother. Scott's like, what? How? And he's like, well, maybe I should wait until after, like, the wedding to let you know.
She's got, like, a banging body, you know, because Jean Grey is, like all the X-Men women, like, super gorgeous and fit-looking.
I thought it was more like one of those jokes, like...
Like, we both date, like, super hot ladies kind of joke.
That's not how I read it at all.
No, I don't know how to read it. That's what I'm asking.
I read it more as, like, there are going to be things, like, in your marriage that are going to be annoying. And, like, if I tell you about them before you're married, maybe you won't want to get married
anymore. Oh, because she's
talking
about her fiery personality.
Yeah.
All right. So my mind's just totally in the gutter. I'm, like, talking about Cyclops' potential virginity and, like, carpet matching the drapes. And you're saying it's about just, like, marriage is tough.
I think it's, like, one of those, like... like, you know, the newspaper comics sort of jokes where it's like, haha, like the old ball and chain. Like, that's how I read that line. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you're probably more correct than I am. But then it also almost seems like a withholding sex joke, too, if that's what he's referring to. If he's like, she's so fiery, you better not get on her bad side, otherwise you're going to get a timeout in bed or something. Because it's like an old-timey, crappy 50s, like, dad joke.
Yeah, totally.
You know what I mean? It's like not a joke that
whichever way it was meant, it's like a crappy dad joke.
And you can read into it a million different, either perverted or, like crappy, like, you know, 1950s, like, white picket fence ways.
We've already gone too
far. Okay, fine, you're right. Okay, that's all I got for this episode. Okay. All right, so I want to remind people that it'd be really nice. Sonia said that I was commanding people to do these things in the plug section last week, where I was saying, I want you to follow me on Twitter.
It was very assertive, that's all.
All right, so I would like people to kindly, if they would like, to follow me on Twitter, at Willie Simpson, if they're in the mood, to rate us 5 stars on iTunes and leave us a nice review. That really helps us out. To follow Eric and Julie Leewald on Twitter at XMTAS, you should do that. And buy their book previously on X-Men. That I must command you to do. You should also join our Facebook group. We've had so many new members join in the past 2 weeks. It's crazy.
Hey, everybody.
So maybe commanding them does work. Hello,
I think you've
taken
on the Scott role and I've taken on the Storm role to match this episode.
Anyway, you can join. The Facebook group is XMTAS Podcast. Right? That's what I forgot the name of it at this point. Right? X-Men Test Podcast. Search it out on Facebook. You'll find us. Ask to join. It's very nice. It's a very nice community. So, I mean, that's all I got to say. Any last words, Sonia?
Maybe I should wait till later to tell you.
Well, I'll meet you at the monorail. Maybe that's where you can let me know. Good night, everybody.
Bye.